Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great podcast, Swagoo and Perk, an ESPN podcast led by its namesake hosts, Marcus Spears, Swagoo, and Kendrick Perkins. With new episodes every Tuesday, Spears and Perkins will bring listeners the latest NBA and NFL news, as well as a look inside their lives, career journey with can't-miss conversations. That's Swagoo and Perk. Listen wherever you get your podcast, and also available on ESPN's YouTube channel. Also, NBA Today, hosted by Malika Andrews, offers exclusive content Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Alongside Malika, there will be a full cast of NBA experts and insiders, including Kendrick Perkins, Chinea Agumake, Vince Carter, Zach Lowe, Adrian Wojnarowski, Ramona Shelburne, and many of our NBA reporters from around the league. Get caught up with the latest from around the NBA on NBA Today on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. And also available as a podcast. Listen to NBA Today wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, talk about what's going on with your boy Djokovic down there in Australia. Also, we got your stories of your homeboys or homegirls going just a little bit too far. But first, all right, the NFL season is over as we speak. People losing their jobs left and right. Matt Nagy lost his job. Mike Zimmer lost his job. Found out Brian Flores lost his job. We got that. A lot going on. But yesterday was not exactly a delightful slate of NFL action, right? Like, what they try to do for the last week of the season is make sure it's all division matchups, so that hopefully you can get some matchups that actually have playoff implications, right? They do that, and they put that together like Steelers-Ravens that had playoff implications. The Steelers ultimately wound up getting in. The Rams and the 49ers had the playoff implications. There was some measure of suspense in how this is all going to end up, and in a year that I think has been marked by, even for NFL standards, a unique level of parity, that these mediocre teams going to wind up making it in. Okay. But Raiders-Chargers was so fascinating because going into the game, everybody understood if one team won, they'd make the playoffs and the other would miss. But if they tied, everybody got into the playoffs from that game. The Raiders would get in and the Chargers would ultimately get in the game in the event of a tie. But nobody really thinks there's much dignity in playing for a tie, right? You take the college football, the most legendary moment of Tom Osborne's career is not winning a national championship in 95 with the greatest college football team ever, perhaps. No, it's the one he didn't win in 1983 when Nebraska played Miami in the Orange Bowl, and I think it was 31-30. And if Nebraska gets the tie, they probably win the national championship. But they went for a two-point conversion, played for the win, did not get it. Miami won the national championship. Now, I could make the argument that if you thought that Nebraska would have been the national champion for taking the tie, you probably thought they should have still been the national champion even though they lost. But that's a logical game that we don't necessarily need to play right now. But the bottom line is, ain't nobody really out here playing for a tie. We've seen guys, I think, in this regular season. I think Frank Reich, it was either this year or last year, had one of those games where it was like, you can play for the tie. He's like, no, we play to win games. That's what it is. But it's different when you put it in the final game of the season and the consequences are laid bare from tying or not tying. Like, they're right there in front of you. All right. So the Chargers and the Raiders are playing, and you can't forget, these are two teams really good at losing. Right? Like, as franchises, as organizations, for the Chargers for their entire existence, for the Raiders really the last 20 years. They're both really, really good at finding ways to lose. The Chargers in particular, excellent at finding ways to lose. So the Raiders up late in this game. Raiders up by 15 points, right? They got this thing. That's how it's looking. All right. Chargers come down, score a touchdown. They're down by 9. Go for the two-point conversion. Get the two-point conversion. They got one more drive to get it done, and it is all fourth down. Like, they just keep getting to fourth down, and then when they get to fourth down, Justin Herbert makes a big throw. Chargers march down the field, get down. They could go for two to win or kick the extra point for the tie. They kick the extra point for the tie. Okay, now we're in overtime. Raiders win the toss, get the ball, march down, score a field goal. Chargers get the ball, march back the other way, score a field goal. Raiders got the ball with like 4 minutes left. If they tie, everybody goes. Okay? So we get to the end of the game, and we're not at midfield, but we're near midfield. I want to say they were in what they called it plus territory. And the Raiders just start calling running plays. They call two running plays in a row to Josh Jacobs. It's coming down to like 30 seconds left in the game. And the Chargers called a timeout. Like, the Raiders are kind of letting this clock go. Chargers called a timeout. And Brandon Staley, the coach, his explanation was he didn't like the nickel personnel they had on the field, knowing they were going to run. So he needed to get different personnel in. Stops the clock. Clock starts again. Raiders get another running playoff, get the first down, kick the field goal, ultimately win the game. Now, Gabe, Brandon Staley has made his name in the NFL in large part because that dude goes forward on fourth down. And I want to say that they got something, either five or six or six or seven fourth downs they converted. But what was the one that they did not convert? It was a fourth and one in the third quarter in their own territory. And when I say their own territory, I mean like the 18-yard line. And they ran and they didn't get it. Raiders got a field goal. That swung the game right there, right? And it's easy to get on Staley, I think, for that. I think it's easy to get on Staley for the timeout. All of that is true. But let me tell you something. The best thing that Brandon Staley did for the overall NFL was not allow that game to play to a tie in the way that it was looking. And I just don't think enough people have talked about this, especially in the face of legal gambling. Playing for the tie under those circumstances, like, how would that not be the fix? The benefit for them playing for the tie is everybody gets in the playoffs, right? But there is an integrity to each individual game. And that integrity involves the idea that everybody's playing to win. Playing to get into the playoffs is not playing to win, right? Like, philosophically, this takes us into an entirely different place than I don't think anybody had ever really considered. But check out this story. I don't know if you saw this. I saw this on ESPN.com this morning, and the headline was, "Books sweat out Chargers Raiders rejoice result." It was going to kill the sports books, Gabe, if that had gone to a tie. Kill them. Kill them. Listen to this. It says, overtime was implemented in 1974. 27 regular season games have ended in a tie. Sportsbooks typically offer anywhere from 60 to 1 odds or higher on a tie. This week at the Borgata in Atlantic City, the odds of the Chargers-Raiders game ending in a tie were bet down from 50 to 1 to 11 to 1. Right? Because it became a whole cool different idea now. Like, oh, if it goes to a tie, everybody gets into the playoffs. But if they had fixed that game like that, like, I'm looking at everything funny under those circumstances. Like, that's just something you can't do. Even if it makes full-on sense in the long run, in the end, the NFL sells games. Like, that's what they sell above all else. You got load management in the NFL in a way that you, I mean, NBA, in a way that you don't have in the NFL, because every game matters in the NBA, in the NFL, in a way that it does not matter in the NBA. It's all based on the idea that you are going to try to win. Like, I was thinking about it with regards to like that Tom Osborne situation, where very often, you know, when these games come in, coach is like, no, we play to win. We play to win. But you're going to get real pragmatic when the playoffs are on this one observation in the entire sample. But I was sitting there at the house and I was watching the Raiders as they were running those running plays. And I'm like, yo, you can't play for a tie when you're in your own territory. Like, just on GP, just on principle, you can't do that. You have to get out here and try to get yourselves a legitimate chance at a field goal. You can't do that. And lucky for everybody, the Raiders wound up getting to that point. But shout out to you, Chargers. I just wasn't sure how you were going to lose this game, right? Even as you made that comeback, right? As it was coming, you know, it was a pretty miraculous sort of comeback they made. Joey Bosa made that big strip sack, but they then were not able to recover the fumble. It's like, I mean, that's when you know the Chargers going to lose. It's under a circumstance like this. It's just like, yo, how are you guys going to find a way to lose? And for my entire life, they have found a way to lose. This is the franchise that once had number one team in the league in total offense, the number one team in the league in total defense, and still didn't make the playoffs. They are inventive. They are creative. They came up with how to do it. Boom. There it was. Way to go, guys. Way to go. In other NFL notes, the Colts. So, you know, they made that trade to get Carson Wentz. And it hadn't been bad, right? Like, he's got some numbers to put up. But you can say he's had a pretty good season, but he's still Carson Wentz. And they wrapping up the year against the Jaguars, who clearly appeared to put a stamp on this season and mail it in quite a while ago. Worst team in the NFL, I think we'd all agree. Bruh. Colts not only lost that game to keep them out of the playoffs, but Carson Wentz took enough snaps and hit all the benchmarks to where now the Colts have to give up their first round pick. Yes. Yes. Couldn't be me, man. Like that sounds absurdly and wildly frustrating if you're going to be a fan of one of those teams, right? Also, Gabe, your 49ers made the playoffs. Your boy Jimmy was looking kind of rough early, but I guess he brought it back around. Flip side of this is Matthew Stafford got out there throwing the ball away again. Like Garoppolo was out there throwing the ball away. Like the thing with Garoppolo is everything about him is results oriented, right? Like at least for the people who are on board with him, you're just not going to be able to convince me that what Garoppolo is able to pull off is really not what Shanahan has been able to pull off. Like, I mean, I feel fairly confident saying that in watching them, but you also have to give the dude credit. If he's out there with a bad thumb, and he does what it takes to get your squad to the playoffs. Like, props. I can't knock you for that. Even, like, regardless of what my criticisms are of him, I can't knock him for that. And now we get to the postseason. And, dude, I got no idea. No idea who's going to wind up winning the Super Bowl. I feel pretty good saying that the Chiefs are going to come out of the AFC. And I feel like we're not viewing the Chiefs in the right context. Or maybe we are, but I don't think that people are treating them like a team that's made the AFC championship game. What is it, three times in a row? It's at least three. Like, that's the thing. It's at least three. They lost to the Patriots that year, and then they won the Super Bowl, and then they went last year, and they lost. Like, normally we give you some props for having built your situation up, right? They got that defense better. Everything is there. There's no other team in that conference that has, like, stepped up in a way that makes you feel good. And then you go look at the NFC, and I think I talked about this with Dominique the other day, but the Packers are built around Aaron Rodgers, and Aaron Rodgers, for them to go to the Super Bowl, is going to have to throw a leather brick around Lambeau Field in the freezing cold. That doesn't feel like an optimal situation. But who else are you going to go with over there, right? Maybe it's Tampa Bay again, but we see how decimated they've been by everything in the East. The Cowboys, you trust them if you want. Right? Like everything's in place for them to do it, but you can trust them if you won't. You feel good about the Rams, right? Like you feel good about the 49ers. You feel good about the Eagles. What is there to feel good about? This to me has just been a largely mediocre NFL season. And I guess we'll see what it all produces when the playoffs come around, but I'm not excited. And I wonder, like I was talking to my father about sports just generally, and he was never able to like get back into them after the shutdown. And I guess I didn't really have that problem because my livelihood depended on it. But I do wonder for a lot of people if there's like a fundamental level of excitement that we used to have around the NFL and a lot of that stuff that's just really being sapped by everything else that's going on around, right? Like there's just, because I just don't feel it in ways I feel like that we used to feel it when this time would come around. And maybe it's because the teams aren't necessarily great, right? Like I don't have an answer for that. But luckily for us, we had the Los Angeles Chargers to keep it interesting, finding that way to lose. Oh, I forgot this too, by the way, before I go on this. Shout out to, I don't even know how to say that man's name, that coaches the Raiders, special teams coach that took over. How worthless does John Gruden seem at this point? I mean, seriously, they gave that dude that 10-year contract for $10 million a year, okay? They bounced him out in the middle of the year, and then they lost Henry Ruggs, and then they lost Arnett, their first-round pick, who was at corner, right? John Gruden's supposed to matter. Like, the whole idea that you have a $10 million coach is the idea that you got a guy that literally cannot be replaced. They made the playoffs without him. It is as if he was never there. And those dudes, like, they overcame a lot. Can you imagine that being your workplace and everything that had taken place in that real short time period? And then you got to get out here and try to find a way to make the playoffs. And they did it. Like, I don't know if that dude's a good head coach, but he's going to have to be the head coach. Because if you thought John Gruden was worth $10 million a year and this dude did the exact same thing, you at the very least think he's worth coaching the Raiders.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, Gabe. So I'm kind of curious if you are picking up on this the same way I have been, as you, your wife is from Western Europe, right? Novak Djokovic is from what is considered to be Eastern Europe. Okay. But I'm a black man from the United States and the South in particular. They just all white folks to me. I don't really have a whole like super breakdown on it. When they come over here to the United States, there was a time where they were being treated as though they were Eastern Europeans. But now, you know, they just white folks. You go up to Chicago, hang out with our Polish brothers and sisters. There was a time where you might have made a distinction, but in the end, they just white folks, right? That's how we kind of see things. But if you in a world where it's all white folks and you got to find a way to make distinctions along those lines, you're going to have like the Eastern versus Western European division. And that is a central theme in what's going on with Novak Djokovic and Australia and COVID and all this stuff, right? So if you haven't seen this story, it's actually really interesting. So Djokovic, who has been Mr. Anti-Vaccine, like, it's not just that he's been like not wanting to get the vaccine, it's just he's been flouting everything that people are trying to do to keep themselves safe. And so Djokovic was headed to the Australian Open and said that he had an exemption that would allow him to play without having taken the vaccine. Okay. And Australia was ready for him to come, because if you are not up on the news and paid attention to what's going on really over there in Australia and New Zealand in particular, but I think Australia has been very similar. Gabe, they've been hardcore about trying to shut this whole virus situation down. Like, they have not taken any chances. I don't know how Americans would have responded to some of the levels of restrictions they had, because their game was not a matter of let's just keep this under control. Their game was, we are going to eradicate this right before it starts. They pulling the weeds out from the root. Like, that had been their entire game, and they was ready for Jokic when he showed up, right? Like, I once saw something once on the internet where this dude told a story that wasn't verified about Michael Jordan coming into a restaurant and they had a strict no cigar smoking policy, but they knew Mike would try to smoke a cigar. So they already planned before he got there what it is that we going to do. So Djokovic is out here on some, I got an exemption. And they were like, yeah, we going to see if you got an exemption. So he gets in and they disregard his exemption. They're like, ain't no exemption. And so Djokovic is like, well, look, can I call the tennis people to talk about this? And the Australian folks said, no, you can't. And they basically told him he was going to have to go back. He went and got, you know, this adjudicated by the judge or whatever, whoever handles these things in Australia. And they said, okay, well, we're going to have a hearing on Monday to decide if your visa gets revoked. Djokovic had the hearing Monday. It's Australia Monday, so it's already happened, right? Djokovic wins. And they say that what he had, they should have given him time to talk to people, that what he got was legit enough and he's good. But gang, they still trying to send him back. Have you seen that?
Australia's immigration minister, Alex Hawke, says he hasn't ruled out invoking his ministerial power and canceling the star's visa, according to the BBC.
Right. So this is not simply about the vaccine stuff, because if he's got the exemption, he's got the exemption. Now, if you want to talk about the fact that in the paperwork, whatever day Djokovic said that he tested positive, there's a picture of him the next day, naked face, around a bunch of people. Like, he's a clown. Like, I don't feel bad calling that dude a clown, right? Like, you know, normally you try to couch this, and I'm not one inclined toward personal attacks and everything else, but it's hard for me to look at Djokovic as anything other than a clown, given what his, like, sum total get down has been on all of this stuff, right? And again, for me, my issue with him is not being unvaccinated. My issue with him is that he's been unvaccinated and loves just to show up places to show people that he will not be denied, right? That nobody will stop him from doing what he wants to do. That's my problem with him. As I've said many times on this show, if you are unvaccinated, there are things that you can do to be safe, and I'm okay with you doing that. And while I get that the point is really just about safety, there is something kind of whack on the way I get around your vaccine requirement is that I already caught it. Now, there's something about that that don't necessarily sit right. Like, I get it, but again, there's something there that doesn't sit right. But this has become a legitimate international incident. And again, what makes it an international incident is not simply about the vaccine. It sure feels like a lot of it has to do with this guy and where he's from. Now, I could be wrong here, but this is not context that you can ignore. Like, these are the geopolitics that you have to keep in mind when we start talking about what's going on overseas. Because what I said about Djokovic was, I was curious to see what exemption he was going to try to break out, because it's not easy to get an exemption. Like, people try to have this thought that they can go get a religious exemption, except there aren't that many religions that are willing to put it down on paper that they are opposed to the vaccine. Like, that doesn't really happen very much. And so I was like, what is he going to present? And is it going to just look like totally fraudulent and everything else? Nope. He was just like, nah, man. I already got it. What you gonna do now? And they're like, we still gonna stop you. How about that? But it seems, and again, Gabe, this is outside. This ain't the tennis people. This is like the Republic of Australia. And they want to prove a point on this dude's back. And as ridiculous as I find him to be, I don't think that's cool. Right? And these are the kinds of things that we have to be able to say in these moments and in these times, right? The goal has to be safety. The goal can't be moralizing. And don't get me wrong. I think there's room for moralizing. I think there's some moralizing that should be done. I think that allowing subjective morality in this case is part of what's gotten us to the place where we are, where a lot of people that I think are engaging in what I would consider to be legitimately, if not immoral, at least amoral behavior, which is just rampant selfishness, have held this up for everybody and made everybody's life more difficult than it should have been. Like, there, I believe that. But the bottom line is, if Djokovic isn't making Australia unsafe by his presence, then you let him in and you let him play tennis. That's what it is. They don't want it from this guy. Now, what I'm curious about, how many other people received a similar exemption? Or will we not find out about other people receiving a similar exemption? Because everybody else just got the damn vaccine. Right? Like, it wasn't germane. It wasn't relevant. It didn't come up with other people. Maybe that's the game that was played. I don't know. But what would be interesting to see, so we can get a full handle on what the game is that they're playing with Djokovic, is how his situation compares to other people who have tried to get by with a similar exemption. Right? Because it seems to me like the Australians are just embarrassed. Like, they went through all of that with him. They felt like he was trying to play them. He wound up with the requisite paperwork. They're like, all right, you got to let him through. Are they trying to save face by fighting even harder? Like, where all does this go? How is he going to be received once the tournament starts? And how much of a jerk is he going to be if he wins? Because I got to tell you, if I were him, that would mean I was a jerk when I showed up. Oh, I'd be a big jerk when I left. If you haven't heard, as part of ESPN Nation, brought to you by Dr. Pepper, college football is back, and so are the fans. Return to glory with Fansville by Dr. Pepper, the one fans deserve.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
This first story comes from Transit.
This is Neil Vigder with the New York Times. Hundreds of drivers were trapped overnight on Interstate 95 in Virginia after a fast-moving winter storm barreled through the region. The snow and ice caused a chain reaction of accidents and jackknife tractor trailers. Emergency responders struggled to reach motorists in what was a frozen quagmire. The people who were stranded included families returning from vacation, truck drivers, and even a sitting United States Senator, Tim Kaine of Virginia, who was the Democratic vice presidential nominee in 2016. Senator Kaine left Virginia for Washington, D.C. at 1 o'clock on Monday afternoon. He didn't arrive at the U.S. Capitol until 27 hours later. Some drivers resorted to walking down highway ramps to get supplies at gas station convenience stores, buying up virtually everything in sight, including fuel. Many people worried about running out of gas and shut off their engines. A father wrapped his daughter in blankets and gave them sparklers to pass the time. He also handed out bottles of water from his car. One woman recalled how her bladder was about to burst from not going to the bathroom for more than 12 hours, and how in the era of COVID, she couldn't go up to a random house and ask to use someone's bathroom. They might ask her to take a PCR test.
I would definitely ask her to take a PCR test under those circumstances. There's no question about that one. And it was wild that day because it was supposed to snow in New York and it didn't. And I didn't really pay any attention. And I just didn't realize how terrible it had all turned, like for the Mid-Atlantic people on there. And I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where your car has died and it's cold outside, but that is misery, man. Just being frozen. And so people were with that dilemma, like, yo, how much gas can I afford to use? I actually read an interesting op-ed that somebody wrote, and I think it was in the Washington Post, but I was just like, oh, this is definitely shoehorning your agenda into reality. And it basically used the shutdowns to make the point of how extra terrible it would have been if everybody drove electric cars, because everybody's battery would have died, and then they would have just been stuck out there. And I'm thinking to myself, yo, well, how about we try to figure out how to take care of these freeways so this kind of stuff doesn't happen? Right. Like that seemed to me to be like the bigger concern was not, oh, what if we have electric cars? Not that that isn't a point, but the idea that that would be the point that you were making in the face of what that was to me was just like a little bit, you know, a little bit off. But man, the folks got stuck out there. I feel bad for them. Like you remember when that happened in Atlanta a couple years ago where they just didn't know it was coming and everybody tried to bail out and then everybody stuck on the freeway.
I mean, it seems like these types of things happen in one of two situations when there's like a historic storm in a place that still expects it, or it happens in a place where it's really not expected to happen.
Right. Well, in Virginia, they kind of see this coming. Like this didn't seem to be like a 2 foot of snow, like nothing's ever happened before. You know, in some ways people just got caught slipping. But for my Atlanta folks, go pick on them about this, please. Like, if you can.
Isn't that like a recurring joke about how people in D.C. like don't know what to do with snow and they freak out?
Yeah, but they get snow. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a thing that doesn't happen like that. But like when that happened in Atlanta, it was just all the, oh, ain't nobody, you know, how y'all ain't ready. How y'all don't know what it is. Da, da, da. All this stuff. All the jokes from a whole lot of people stuck on that freeway. I see you.
All right, this next story comes from Tech.
This is Will Knight, senior writer at Wired. I wrote about John Deere unveiling the very first fully autonomous tractor. So back in 1837, blacksmith John Deere began selling steel plows out of a shop in Grand Detour, Illinois. That's about as far as you can get from a Silicon Valley founding myth. But in recent years, the farm equipment giant that still bears his name has embraced robotics and artificial intelligence in a huge way. At the CES trade show in Vegas, Deere unveiled the 8R tractor, which uses 6 pairs of stereo cameras and advanced artificial intelligence to perceive its environment and navigate. The tractor can plow or sow seeds all on its own while maneuvering around obstacles, and a farmer can simply send new instructions through a smartphone app. It could someday replace workers, something that could be good or bad depending on your perspective. Jeremy Hindman, Deere's chief technology officer, describes it as a monumental shift. I think it's every bit as big as a transition from horse to tractor, he told me. But not everyone is on board. There are questions about who owns the data the tractor collects, which could be used to study how best to make use of land. Tractor owners could potentially be locked into Deere's ecosystem, and have to pay extra if they want to glean insights about their own land. One critic went so far as to liken Deere to the Facebook of farming.
Yo, the farmers. Here's the thing that I thought about. If you are a farmer, right, a guy who drives around the tractor, there are many things that could make your life easier. I don't feel like the self-driving tractor is one of them. In fact, from my experience of growing up around people who own tractors and use them, they kind of enjoy it. Like, this is not the thing that they need removed from their lives. And I'm trying to figure out. So if you're the farmer and they're like, all right, well, you ain't got to drive the tractor no more. So what am I going to do with that time now? Right? Like, how is this is this improving my efficiency by allowing me to go and do something else? Like, I just feel like that's a place where the rank and file base of their customers has no interest in this. But of course, if you a guy who runs a farm, this is like the greatest news that you have ever heard. In season two of The Wire, I'll never forget, ahead of the game on this one, they brought all the longshoremen in for some demonstration about how like robots and all this stuff were going to start unloading the docks. And all these cats saw was them losing their jobs. Like a man said, he said that, you know, they could replace farmers, which is good or bad, depending on perspective. Look, man, here's the thing. Those farmers going to have to do some kind of job no matter what. So what's that job going to be? Because it ain't like being a farmer's a job that you can really transfer into a whole lot of other stuff in this modern economy. The only people that the idea of the automated tractor is good for is people who don't need things to be any better for them. Super rich conglomerates. That's it. It ain't helping not one person on the ground. You're taking it away from, they don't even get to have the fun of driving the tractor.
All right, but Monty, this last one comes from science. Here it is.
My name is Matt Reynolds, and I'm a senior writer at Wired. I've been writing about one of the big problems we're going to face as more of our electricity is produced from renewables. We know that the way to reduce emissions from our electricity is to generate power from solar panels and wind turbines instead of from coal and natural gas plants. But what do we do when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing? We need a way to store all that green energy and release it exactly when we need it. Now, some companies are turning to an unusual technology to store that green energy, and they're called gravity batteries. Here's how they work. When you've got too much renewable electricity, like if it's a really bright or windy day, you can use that excess electricity to lift a really heavy weight, a concrete block or a huge bag full of dirt. Now, you might remember from physics class that lifting a heavy object stores that energy. And when you need to release that energy again, you can let gravity do the work. And as the block drops, it spins a motor and that generates electricity. A Los Angeles-based company called Energy Vault has already built a prototype system in Switzerland that does exactly that. It's a 75-meter tower that lifts and drops 35-ton concrete blocks to store and release energy. The firm says that this technology could help intensive industries like hydrogen production and mining use more renewable energy, and its plan has already attracted hundreds of millions of dollars in investment. Other companies want to use gravity batteries in slightly different ways, to make electricity grids more reliable, for example. But gravity isn't the only way to store energy. Lithium-ion batteries, like the ones in electric vehicles, have plummeted in cost over the last few decades. And these types of batteries are by far the most popular form of energy storage for new power infrastructure. The question is whether giant concrete batteries are a niche solution for a few specific industries, or if they're the future of energy storage more widely. And whatever the answer, we do know that if we want to make our electricity greener, we need to solve this storage problem one way or another.
All right, Gabe. So I want to make sure I understand this. Basically, they're saying that a way that they can generate energy is to take big old blocks, raise them up, and drop them.
You can generate energy from dropping them. You store it from picking the concrete block up.
Got it. Dropping a block creates the energy. Okay. There is somebody at which one of these companies, right? There's somebody who is sitting around. Why don't we just drop bricks? Right? Seems really simple, right? Why don't we drop bricks? But wasn't so sure about saying it out loud or even said it out loud at a meeting. Like, why don't we drop bricks? Drop bricks. But then the right person had this idea and maybe put some more fancy words behind it. And the next thing you know, everybody's like, yeah, we should drop bricks. Like, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but this seems like one of these very simple ideas that nobody just ever said out loud before. And then it was like, yeah, why didn't we think of this sooner, right? Somebody got promoted and somebody's sitting in the back with his arms folded. Like, man, how many times I've been told y'all about dropping bricks? I'll say this other thing I thought when I saw this thing about these people dropping bricks. That sounds like an example of a term that I'm not necessarily, hey, man, I'm absolutely not going to use here, right? But there is a term that is used in some places in some parts of the country when somebody comes up with, shall we say, a simple yet unconventional solution to an engineering problem, shall we say. And it reminds me of this on this term. I know a person who worked in the Deep South who was an African-American, and her assistant, I guess secretary is the term we used to use, was a Caucasian-American. And something had happened, and the African-American person had to use one of these forms of, shall we say, rudimentary engineering to create a solution to a problem in a pinch. And this person looks at the Caucasian and says, well, there's a word we use for this, but I can't say it. And the Caucasian looked at her and said, oh, no, we use that word, too, which I had never considered. By the way, that had crossed over in such a way. In fact, I don't even know where it started. It may have crossed over to us. I have no idea. But anyway, this seems like a high science version of this, shall we say, rudimentary form of engineering.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. I thought it might be a good time to bring back that time that your friend that goes too far took things a little too far, farther than that.
Yes.
There wasn't anything necessarily that sparked that in my frame of reference. I just thought it's been a little while since we did that.
Indeed.
Thought I'd bring it back. Our first one comes from Anthony in California. Here it is.
So when I was in high school, about freshman year in high school, I had this friend that would sit there and walk across the street whenever he felt like it. This man would walk out into traffic if he had to cross the road. He didn't want to walk to the crosswalk. Every time I hung out with him, I would walk to the crosswalk. One day I was in the car with my dad, and this man walked out right in front of us, and my dad knew his dad. And he said, don't you ever do that with him. I told my friend, don't walk out in the middle of the street. You're going to get hit by a car. And my friend said, well, if they hit me, I'm going to sue them. So I said, okay. Sure enough, a few weeks later, this man got hit by a car, and the car did not stop. This man got hit, and the car kept going. And when I saw him at school, because by the grace of God, he wasn't hurt. He was just bruised up and beat up as he should have been. I saw him. I said, you sue? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, because they hit me and kept driving.
Wow. He took a hit and run. Wow.
That's a layer I hadn't quite anticipated, is the hit and run. There's no option to sue unless you got like a good look at the license plate.
Hey, man, and let me tell you something. Ain't many things more indicator of dealing with a substandard human being when somebody believes that the solution to the problem is just suing. I'm just going to sue. Who thinks like that? Yeah, like, that's just crazy talk. Like, what are you going to do if you get hit by a car? I'm going to sue them. Okay, we asked about what you're going to do if you get hit by a car.
All right, this next one comes from Neil in Brooklyn.
I got to tell you about this time my boy Rob decided that he was going to go up to Madison High School and fight for the respect of a young lady. He was dating this cheerleader that went to Madison, and, you know, everybody was hyped for him and everything. She was a fine girl and all that. So somehow some football players disrespected her or whatever. So he decided that we were going to head up there, have him settle it with this girl's ex-boyfriend or whatever. Now, at the time, it was me, Rob, and my homeboy Marcelino. So it was just three of us headed up. And I was there the entire time trying to talk him out of it. Like, I don't know if you want to go up to the school and do this, seeing that this young man's on the football team. So, well, he wasn't going to hear it. And I was like, I don't think he's about shooting a fair one, but whatever it be, it be. So lets out, his girl comes down, and she's pressuring him to leave. She's like, yo, you got to go. You got to get out of here. He's got his team, and they're coming looking for you. And he's like, yo, we got to go. So me, him, and Marcelino take off back to Marcelino's car, which is probably about 2 blocks away from the school. Why did we park so far from the school? I don't know. So we're on our way running back to the car, and all we see is all the jerseys just come running up the block looking for us. Like, oh, shit. So me and Marcelino, like, yo, Rob, run to the car, and then they get out of there. We'll try to hold them off. Why are we trying to hold them off? I don't know. So we decided to just stand there. Marcelino pulls a bat from the movie, his backpack, and he's ready to go. I'm standing there without my hands. I'm like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And this football team just runs right by us, still chasing Rob. I don't know if I was lucky or dumb that day, but luckily we all got out of there okay, and we lived to fight another day. That's the last time I let a friend of mine get me into some trash.
Yeah, like I feel like it's a very particular person and personality type that breaks out the baseball bat. Baseball bat comes out like you are dealing with people who are not playing games when the baseball bat comes out. Like when you really stop and think about it, especially given baseball's decline in popularity, why does anybody even have one of those things? And it's to wail on somebody. That's why. To collect on debts.
And bats can be had pretty cheaply at like a Big Five, you know, sporting goods in your local neighborhood.
Yeah, I just can't imagine myself being like, yo, I got to go to the store and get a bat. And like, if your kids are on the baseball team, chances are they got bats already. It's not quite like brass knuckles where it's like, what other reason do you have to possess this? But it's getting close.
All right, this last one, the guy didn't leave his name or where he's from. It's a good one to close us out. Here it is.
We're back in college, right? And I had a friend who was trying to make some money off his refund check. Bets another dude that he can beat him for like $100 in a 3-on-3 game. So my friend gets this other guy and me to be on his team. Thing is, he severely overrated my skills, and the other two guys on our team were not good at all, so he thought that I alone could win this game. Other guys, right? One of them, you know, was kind of fat. The other guy looked like a bodybuilder, so he thought they was weak. Turns out the dude who was a bodybuilder played JUCO, and the kind of fat guy was really, really good too. So we got destroyed. My friend thinks it was an anomaly. Doubles down. So now it's $200 in the game. We lose again. This fool loses $200, right? Out of like $500. He was broke the rest of the season. That's just so mad foolish.
Wow. I'm definitely not putting my money on other people's skills. Not the way I handle my finances.
I thought it was an anomaly.
Oh, no, no. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Neil Vigdor of The New York Times. Check out his story on the I-95 gridlock during that snowstorm at The New York Times. Thanks to Will Knight of Wire. Check out his story about John Deere self-driving tractors at Wired.com. And thanks to Matt Reynolds of Wire. Check out his story on gravity, maybe solving an energy problem. That's also at Wired.com. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.